Come on. Yes. So we're starting to record topic 7. Although we didn't quite finish last week's topic, but there's such a lot of overlap between the two that I think I won't go through the final slides from Jonas on autopoiesis, but I'd like you to be bearing them in mind. Right, so we're looking at Heidegger's account of all right, Nicolette, if you could let it go, which preceded Jonas by a number of years. So we're looking about 1929, 1930, and I'm not sure if Jonas himself was necessarily aware of these lectures. Because they weren't published until later. I'm just checking now for those of you on the... this English translation was published in 1995. I don't know when the German was. 83. So, yes, yeah, so I think Jonas wasn't aware of what Heidegger had to say. Because he might well have influenced him. Because if you remember, Jonas was not really drawing a distinction when he was talking about life between animal life and human Dasein. Not that he would use that term. And at the end of the last lecture, Joe should be here because Joe, I think, brought it up, that question. So what distinguishes, human Dasein from the kind of life that we're looking at of the unicellular life, multicellular life, the life of plants, the life of animals, what sort of distinction do we have? Do we draw here philosophically, and not just philosophically, because Heidegger's idea of philosophy, which is I think shared not just by it's not just Heidegger's idea, is that all of the sciences have philosophical foundations. That they are unable to clarify by themselves. So once a science is launched, in a sense, the philosophical foundations have already been set. Although crises occur in science where they're overturned, but when they're overturned, that's a philosophical question. I think we've covered this already, just in passing, thinking about physics. You know, physics went through its crisis with relativity and quantum mechanics, and the physicists themselves had to become philosophers, in a sense, because they had to change their understanding of being as a result of the revolution in science, much as we looked at Galileo and Newton had to change their understanding of being to develop mechanical philosophy, the mechanical science. So each scientific revolution is intimately wrapped up with the philosophical foundations. And this is interesting because Heidegger, this particular lecture, is interesting because Heidegger very rarely gets his hands dirty in that way. He says that, but then he doesn't go and say, well, the philosophical foundations of physics ought to be this. But he's actually... now looking at the philosophy of biology in a way. What are the foundations or key distinctions? And this is Joe entering. I've already been talking about you, Joe, because you partly chose this reading this week because you were talking about the distinction we draw between animal consciousness and human consciousness. I don't know if you remember the end of the last lecture.
It came up, but yeah. I didn't remember that being distinctly in conversation.
We were talking about language and image making.
Yes.
Yeah. Because in fact, Jonas does have an essay on image making as something he picked on to say this is distinguishes the human, if you like, the image making that, and it's a good place to it's a good thing to study because. It's very hard to pinpoint the birth of language because the material traces are hard to fathom. Whereas image making cave painting, it's there's actual evidence. But when I was reading Jonas, I was just so strongly reminded of what Heidegger had to say about it, and how Heidegger, I feel, in a way, is approaching it inwardly. I mean, if you've done the reading, one of the questions about this is, how on earth could Heidegger know what he knows, what he claims to know, in what he's saying here about the essence of organism? Because it's no longer empirical. You know, last week with Jonas, it was, and we were looking at autopoiesis. Autopoiesis has an certain empiricism to it. You know, you can actually study the cell, and you can find autopoietic processes going on. And even the idea of autopoiesis didn't come out of introspection; it came out of actually studying metabolism. Whereas, if you've read this week's reading, you might be inclined to say, well, how does Heidegger know this? And I guess the bits where he discusses that have been missed out because the reading had to be chunked down. But he does claim that we have a certain knowing of what it is to be an animal, because we're, I don't think he puts it so simplistically, because we are animals. You know, we're at a certain... he wouldn't say we are animals, but we have a certain kinship, that would be a better way of putting it, and a certain understanding of what it is to be an animal, which he doesn't go into, he just states that's how it is.
In the reading, does he not say that we can't know that? I mean, he talks about you know, that it's not possible for us to know what a bee experiences when it sees.
Yes.
Even though we might be able to use instruments to see this is what happens when a bee sees, we don't know that that is what it sees.
Well, I'm without getting into unless we can pull the reading out.
Oh, okay.
My understanding of what he said there was that we can't project our form of seeing.
Mm.
And think that the bee sees like we do.
Yes, that's right.
But that doesn't mean that we can't, in some sense, have some idea of what it is to be a bee. And because he is saying that he does know what it's like to be a bee, in saying that he knows the bee doesn't see like we do.
Do you know?
First of all, he's saying and he uses the word abyss, so that separates us from the animals, which is a very unpopular thing to say in our time.
He says that animals are poor in the world.
Yes. It's especially an unpopular thing to say in England, because everyone believes that their dog is a human being.
But what does he mean by poverty in the world? Because it's that... The reading started with that.
Yes, and there's a lot of background to what he's doing here, and he's not really primarily interested in finding out... He is interested in finding out what the essence of animality is, but his main thrust is not to discover that, but he wants to... It's something we were looking at already. He wants to indicate what it is to have world. And he wants to indicate what it is to have world in a negative way by saying that the animal is poor in world. So he's going into this is my understanding of it. He's going into great depth about what it is to... what is the essence of animality, and what is it like to be an animal? To in some sense, at the back of what's going on here is text. Yes, what's going on here is his intention really, which is unstated in the reading, is to illuminate our own having of world by setting it off against what it is to be an animal. And last week, I was doing that in a more modern way, in the way that more recent analytical philosophy of mind has done by trying to set off not doing it as well as Heidegger, I don't think, by setting off our being conscious against the idea of a zombie. Yes, I was trying to do you see it's one of these, it's again, when you deal with Heidegger, it's always like this. It's like you're already in the ocean, surrounded by water, and you've got to try and catch or distinguish, well, what is it? What's this water? I mean, but the water is being. What he's calling here, manifestness of being. Well, you don't notice it because that's just how it is all the time. But you can indicate it by, by a certain understanding of what it would be like to be without it. And a zombie is an extreme example, and Heidegger's taking the idea or the example of what it is to be an animal. And in the background, he's saying, as soon as you see what's going on with the animal, you see how we're not like that, and that not being like that is the having of world. In particular, in this series of lectures, he's got three propositions that are sort of setting off each other. One is that the stone is worldless, and the animal is poor in world, and we are world forming. Poor in world.
Would you put plants with animals?
He doesn't talk about plants. I think if he was going to talk about plants, he would probably have to distinguish another form of being. And certainly Aristotle did. He thought there was a vegetative soul as distinct from an animal soul.
I know people with one of those.
And I think the experience of that Heidegger's talking about of animality is something that we can have or fall into. But we'll examine that, I think, as we go, because he doesn't talk about that. But my sense is that the reason we understand, or I understand what he's talking about, is because he's talking about something, if you've read the reading, called captivation. And I think there's a certain sense that we do understand captivation. And there's a certain sense, that certainly in our older human culture, when we were civilized, in quotes, there was the idea that a human being can become less than human.
I think virtue.
Yes, but it, as in for, enter into a lower state of and you can't really use the word consciousness when you're talking Heidegger. I mean, lower state of consciousness.
Babies.
Let's start. I've got a reading about that I nearly gave you this week about how a world is formed in children from Piaget, because I know that you're interested in that. Mm. I don't know. Phenomenologically, when I look at a baby and I look at a dog, the baby's open in a way that the dog isn't. But that's just, you can argue that. My sense is that a human child is born with a certain openness that is already beyond that of an animal, even though you could say they don't have a world yet. The openness in which the world is going to form seems to me to be there. I don't know that I have Nicola and I don't have kids, so I haven't seen a newborn. Nicholas, of course.
I mean, sort of newborns, I feel like they're just machines.
Like little animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, worse.
Worse. Worse.
A little animal, you see, they're trying to walk. Yeah. But the newborn baby is just...
The world is less developed.
Yeah, but I guess I... I'm talking about the babies in... that I've seen in Waitrose, you know, who are just lying in the pram. And it seems to me in a state of bliss sometimes. You know, that
Oh, they're just filling their nappy.
Yeah, yeah. Or but whatever. I never see a dog just gazing like that. You know.
Cats do.
We should show them a picture of you, John, in your pram.
Oh yeah, Buddha baby. I'm the Lord of all I survey. I'm up in my pram. Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing pram, his mum.
Yeah, the 1950s. Yeah.
Sort of pram. So he's sitting up there, about to sort of tell you all about.
I'm about to give you this lecture, you know.
So what is what does, because I've struggled with that, what does Heidegger mean by captivation?
Well, I'd like to, you know, like go with Heidegger this week and just build slowly to that, because he does a build up, right, where he lays a ground and a bit more ground,
yeah,
and a bit more ground,
like painting.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm
reminds me a lot of painting, the way Heidegger speaks.
Yes,
it's like making objects on a canvas.
Yes,
in a very kind of free form.
And I was discussing, where does Heidegger get this knowledge from, if indeed it is knowledge? And to which I have to say, well, it's somewhat mysterious. I don't have an answer. In a way, the way I read Heidegger, especially as he gets more interesting like this, is I just follow him along, you know. And this is how he says it: I'm taking you. I'm going along a certain way here. I don't know where it's going. I don't really know. I don't think he himself quite knows where what he's finding is coming from. But it's for him. It's entirely, again, another big part that's missing from this is the, which we did deal with somewhere, I think at the beginning of this course, about attunement. Remember, we talked about attunement. That was from the beginning of this
lecture series.
Yeah, the first lecture. Yes. So he's assuming, he's saying, I'm in a certain attunement here, and I'm assuming you are too, my students, because you've just been through this whole course together. And in a way, I'd like to say, well, and I assume too that we're in there's a certain attunement that we've got from studying what we've studied that we need to bring to bear on this. That isn't just a rational scientific understanding. And again, the main confirmation I get from Heidegger is that when I've read something that I haven't understood very well, it often recurs on me much later, and I say, ah, I see what he meant. It doesn't just go away, you know. I see what he meant. Particularly, when my mum's, we had quite a lot to do with my mum's dog, who died. So I started to see something of this in being with him, what Heidegger was saying. Quite spontaneously, you know, it started to come up about this ring of disinhibition, which we're going to come to, and what is it this, you know, looking into an animal's eyes, when you, especially a dog, if you've had a close, you know, pet like that, there's a kinship there, and yet there's a certain not meeting that I think you can discover what Heidegger's talking about by looking at by actually being with an animal quite closely and seeing if you can avoid projecting your being human into them. Do you know? Yeah.
We're more like visual organisms. We rely on visual data more than anything else, maybe. But the dog, it relies on other data coming from other senses.
Yes, but Heidegger's got an essential insight about Dasein, about the being of Dasein, which he holds to, which he says we're not. You know, this continuum that Jonas is talking about, saying the way the species evolved, that we're just, there's a continuum between us and all the rest of the species. Heidegger sees that there's something completely discontinuous about us.
I wondered about I'm totally happy with his distinction between inanimate and animate objects, you know, about extants and living things. I mean, I get that, and I think that's right. I'm less happy about some of his pronouncements about animals not being world-forming. I mean, we know that some animals use tools, that they alter their environments. There's been quite a lot of studies on that.
Well, I mean, I guess the pertinent studies here are to do with sign language in chimpanzees.
Right.
So the tool using can be explained away, but it becomes particularly the people who've adopted chimpanzees as, you know, when they're babies and actually brought them up and taught them to sign, and the sort of things. One of the things I was just checking it out beforehand, because I know this is the area. Is there really such a discontinuity between us and the higher apes? Because that's where it would be, right?
Mm.
That if you're going to look for it, you'd say there's an absolute difference here. And there was a chimp called Washoe.
Mm.
Yeah, who the people who brought Washoe up are moving away, leaving. I don't know if it was a him or a her. It's a her.
She.
Yeah, behind, and she signs to the people who are remaining, Washoe sad.
Mm.
Oh.
Mm.
But do you see the actually they're leaving and the actual turning and saying Washoe sad.
Mm.
There's something uncanny in that, isn't there?
The other way of looking at it is to look at the studies of children that have been brought up by animals.
Yes.
Because a lot of people who've studied those children suggest that they're not human.
Yes.
That although they have human bodies and human brains, they're not human in the way that other people are.
Yes.
Because they never acquire language.
Yes. So that, I mean, some of the crucial thing here is, in a way, almost the distinctions that Heidegger's making has a lot to do with language.
Mm.
And if a human child doesn't get language, it seems they don't have a world in the sense that Heidegger means it.
Mm.
And if we can bring a little chimp in to signing, they start to have a world. So it doesn't. And Heidegger's not, you know, an oracle.
Mm.
He doesn't know for sure where this boundary lies. And there is some kind of sense of empirical science where it may be possible that we can pull, if we really were determined to do it, that we could pull some of the higher apes, individuals, over the line.
And Neanderthals had cave art, by the way. They found now. So.
Yeah.
They have
what? The
Neanderthals did cave art.
Cave art.
So
yeah.
Thinking about Jonah saying, "Well, you know, we can stop the human at the image making." Well. Neanderthals are not Homo sapiens, but they
have cave art. Yeah. But the, I guess the thing on the other side that would be said, and I think this is pertinent, is that it was human Dasein that created language, or discovered language.
That's what you were saying.
Yeah. Again, consciousness is a difficult word, especially when we're with Heidegger, because Heidegger thinks that we've objectified something that can't be objectified with that word. So he kind of leaves it out. If he was going to say what consciousness is, he would say something like it's the manifestness of being, which takes the subjectivity out of it. Do you know, he's on a bit of a... The way that he uses language has got behind it a sort of a sense that he wants to be behind this division into subjectivity and objectivity that is embedded in our language. So he's in a way... I sometimes question whether I should call this course philosophy of consciousness... and do so much Heidegger, because Heidegger would hate that title. But I think consciousness is the right word for our time. Yes, it's the word that we use for our time, and it's great interest to philosophy and cognitive science at the moment. It's a key area of research, so that's partly why I flagged the course.
It's
a hot topic, as they call it. You know, there are a lot of people, I digress, in academia who decide what to research by how hot the topic is. You know, no pursuit of truth. They just feel for the temperature. What's the hot topic? If you've got the hot topic, you'll get published. Yeah, you'll be able to build a reputation. But we're not doing that. Or I'm not doing that. Consciousness.
Yeah, I hear a lot of people talk about free will, consciousness.
Yes, it's at a certain, I think I mentioned this before, but for a long time, right into the 1990s, consciousness in mainstream academia was considered to be, if you were interested in consciousness, you were in some sense a bit unreliable. That's right. Not a hard-nosed research, you know, not a hard-nosed... Well, that's in my world, you know, which is computer science, you know, hard science, that side of things. I don't mean in the humanities, because I guess I was on that divide that actually regarded the whole of the humanities as unreliable. So there's still that. I forget the guy who made that distinction. He gave a talk in the 1950s about this chasm between the sciences and the humanities, which to an extent you're getting, you know, when I discuss science, I'm discussing the hard sciences. I know that Maria often has a word for the humanities, and in fact if you were to look at FAB is a sort of a humanities based university, you know, most of the people here are on that side of things, whereas I'm more on the other side. But I'd rather see myself as the unification. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the bridge. That's right. The what is an organism? I'm just saying that. Of course, if Heidegger and Husserl were to say, "Well, what side are you on?" they'd say, "Oh, we're on the side, if you like, of the." No, I wouldn't like to say that. Certainly Husserl would say he's on the side of science, exact science. Heidegger's more of a bridge as well. So let's just start looking at some of the earlier statements. So an organism is something which possesses organs. So Heidegger's swimming, fishing around, right? Saying, how are we going to approach this? Do you get the feeling? He's got a question. How are we going to approach this? I mean, I take this as another kind of... How do you philosophize? Yes, you start with the language, and you start with what empirical science has to say, and you start to look into see what you can find there, and where it's quite a remarkable process of
carrying the dough.
Yes, but he certainly has the you know, we were talking about nominalism as a result of. Modern science and Darwinism, nominalism comes to the sense that there are no essences. There's nothing essential. When we use a word, it's just to name a collection of objects. And there's nothing intrinsic behind that we're naming. We're just saying all these objects have something in common, and we call that class of objects by this name. The name doesn't refer to something essential that unifies those objects, something behind them, you know. And realism is the sense that the concepts that we use actually refer to something essential. And Heidegger has a certain essentialism in language. He has this, when he starts to look into language, he has the he's searching for the essential meaning of the words, and he has a sense in, and I think without trying to prove it. Reading Heidegger, you start to get the sense of that language has this world-forming character in it. and that there are essential meanings behind the words that we use that actually have to be discovered, that in some sense language is already out there, and there are essential meanings in language, where they came from. You could say they come from the collective experience of the human race, but there seems to be a certain, I don't know if you've ever got this sense, a kind of deep intelligence in language.
Yeah, but language is also used, I mean, you think about 1984?
Yes.
George Orwell's 1984, and how, you know, that society used language to obfuscate what was actually going on.
That society... It's called now, isn't it? It's called the realm of our own public discourse. It's all double speak, isn't it? As soon as somebody who represents the state starts to talk, there's what's being said, and then the media's done this. Every public statement of a politician. Is lacking any reference to the truth and real meaning. It's an attempt to avoid getting in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But in a sense, that just robs it of all of its. It's no longer a genuine attempt to communicate. I mean, there's something awful in it.
Mm-hmm.
In the public discourse, you can see the people up there. These are the people who are running the country, taking the decisions. You can see their little brains going. I'm just going to translate that into this double speak. The one thing I must not do is say actually what I mean. And for a little while, Jeremy Corbyn, because he hadn't been trained, was just saying what he meant. You know, I don't think he's doing that so much now because he got hit so hard. You know, that's our public world. Terrible place.
It's something that Nietzsche tells about every human being. That we speak something, but we are only dissimulating what we really want. Because we want to be... Already we have this feeling that we are social.
Yes.
Then we try to... don't show our real meaning, but try to give the idea that we want the good for everybody. But at the end, we are dissimulating.
Yes.
Right. Something that Nietzsche was telling about the human being, no?
Yes.
And you can't really personify anybody if they don't behave like that. Because there's still people like baseball teams, for example, people personifying them. As if, like, you personify the weather, as if the weather is something. Politicians, if they behave like that, then they're not people. They just... Because when you say a person, this person is somehow talks about their own meaning, communicate something.
Yes, but they haven't stopped being...
They possess.
They haven't stopped being human beings, the politicians. And quite often when they've retired and they're out, you know, then they can start saying... They can start telling you... from themselves,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And with the dissimulation, of course, I see myself dissimulate usually when I deal with people who have power, you know, almost inevitably, if they have power over you and then you start to, you almost can't help, there's something starts calculating not to, you don't displease power-possessing people unless you're willing to take the consequences. You know, something in us knows that at quite a deep level. But we have, in a forum like this, there are many possibilities of communication, you know, especially when we become interested in something for its own sake. You know, then our communication is then directed towards... understanding. That's the great thing about education, isn't it? That we're not in the right spirit. It's not a self-interested thing. We're dedicating our intelligence to something beyond ourselves. And as soon as we do that, we can start communicating in a different way. Yes. Anyway, that's another huge digression, and we're just on slide one. I don't know how we got to that. Oh, yes. So, yeah, we're just talking about Heidegger's just going into language and the sense that, he, in a way, he's almost exploring language here. He's almost exploring, well, what do we mean by these words? He throws himself into a whole question here about, which, if you were at the earlier part of this course, wasn't it? We were looking at Hammer's equipment, instruments, weren't we?
Obsessed.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. But
apparently he grew up surrounded by the sound of hammering.
Did he?
Yeah, yes, yes.
Yes,
he was...
Chink, 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 chink. Drove him mad, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yes, he loves the to use the hammer as the example of the of a piece of equipment, and he wants to. His first question is, well, in what aren't our eyes and hands and arms and ears really pieces of equipment, instruments that we use? What's the distinction between these things and pieces of equipment? I think we should. You're probably aware now that this is 1929, right? Before we've got, bionic ears and artificial limbs that are now being connected up to the nervous system, where this question about what's the difference between an organ and a piece of equipment is a bit like where does humanness come between the higher apes and the boundary isn't quite as sharp as it seemed in those days. You know, the idea that we're going to start to implant technology into our bodies more and more is becoming a reality now. I mean, I remember this was in the 90s, where somebody was in a computer science conference, an American, I think, saying, you know, I can hardly wait for my son to have a chip, you know, inserted in his brain. You know, he just thought that was just great. He'll become a genius, you know, overnight. You know, there's no need to do any mathematical calculations anymore. You just hook yourself up to the chip. The chip does the calculations, you get the answer, just like the fingers do the typing, you know. How do you integrate this? I just kind of say, send the signal to the chip sends the answer, it's all, and this sort of, right, so, I mean, there are philosophical experiments that say, that are kind of, you know, coming close to being true, thought experiments that say, okay, so you're conscious now, and you think you're being conscious is something to do with having a body, let's replace your foot with a bionic foot, and now your legs, now your arms. Let's give you an artificial heart. Now your liver. Now your lungs. Well, in fact, let's replace your whole torso. Right, just got a head on top now, and let's replace the head. Let's replace your eyes. Let's replace your ears. Still conscious? Yeah, still conscious. Still conscious. All right, let's get right in the brain now. Let's just replace your visual cortex with some circuitry that does exactly what your visual cortex does, right? Still conscious? Can you still see? At what point? Is there a point where you would stop being conscious as you slowly replace everything in your body with what's called the functional equivalent? I mean, my thinking on that was at a certain point you would become, there wouldn't be any consciousness left. But the machine would still not. there'd be you'd be in there saying no, no, but you wouldn't be able to say no, no, because the machine won't say no. You won't even, after a while, you won't even be able to think no, no. You'll just, you know.
But how are you going to replace the memory? Where is it?
Well, according to this model of things, it's in the form of the connection of the synapses in your brain. So we reproduce those connection synapses, and when I say, tell me about your childhood, out it comes.
The machine can reply to that?
Well, not, this is a thought experiment, so we're a long way from doing that. And there is, you know, Bergson started the idea that, in fact, seriously in philosophy, that memory can't be explained in those terms. That the brain, in a certain sense, is a sort of a device that gives you access to some immaterial world of memory. But because obviously, if you destroy a bit of the brain, you don't remember anymore. See Rupert Sheldrake on that.
Yeah.
But the jury's out, and I wouldn't be surprised. There's an awful lot of neurons up there, and each of them has thousands of connections to all the other neurons. There's certainly the capacity to store the memories that you are able to retrieve within that neural network. There's not a lack of capacity for that. Because in fact, if you really look into it, what you can retrieve is very little. And then you think, oh no, it's not. I can have this incredible reconstruction of my early childhood, but you don't know anymore if that was really how it was, or whether it's something your brain's producing now, along with the feeling. It certainly was like that. Do you know? It's not at all. I never like to place a bet with science, a bit like the church said, you know. You'll never be able to explain the evolution of the species with Darwinian principles. It's like saying you'll never be able to explain memory by looking into the connections in the brain. But certainly, that seems to me within the bounds of possibility that'll all occur. So this question that Heidegger's asking, what's the distinction between us and machines? You know, in 1929, we're just looking at, diesel engines. You know, that's the idea of the computer is yet to appear. You know, you've got a few clever calculators. That's about the limit of the. So the sense that he has of what machines are capable of is very limited by the times that he's living in. But at the same time, I think somebody who's a diehard materialist would then say, it's just all out of date. We can ignore it. He didn't know what was coming. Whereas I don't look at this like that. I think essentially what he was talking about is still relevant. But it's relevant from in the way that, you know, we were looking at Jonas last week. It's relevant in the sense that, but there is something. There's this other dimension, this experiential dimension to life that a machine doesn't have. But we're into a whole area now which there have been enormous philosophical wars over this.
There were early experiments in Pavlov as well. He was the leading figure of doing this experiments on dogs. I think there are also a lot of videos on YouTube about it. So Pavlov dog experiment, beheading the dog, behead the dog,
sure.
And connect it with wires and artificial heart, and just resuscitate the animal. And the animal starts moving.
Oh, that's horrible.
Ears. I don't know if it's true, because there was a lot of propaganda back in the days, in early during the 20s, 30s in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
So you see these videos.
Well, but vivisection like that.
They kill the dog and they resuscitate.
Heidegger goes on about vivisection in this piece that you gave us about with the bees.
Yeah, cutting the antler.
Cutting the abdomen.
They just decapitate the dog and connect it to a machine, and the dog starts moving. And
then
they put it back into his body. And I don't know if that's.
But the entire. World of vivisection is based on a mechanistic understanding of life.
Descartes did similar things.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. When we're
putting like tech into things, it would be like.
Well, I mean, I remember the we were going to fiddle around with frogs' legs in biology at school, and that's when I left biology.
Mm.
So I thought. The same for me.
Yeah.
Chemistry and physics, nice intellectual stuff, you know, no blood and gore there, you know.
Tech
I've become much more interested.
The galvanic experiments, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, twitch, yeah. It turns out biology is very interesting, but not as it was being taught at school. You know, it's intellectually, it is probably the most interesting science now for us, this question of what is life. But you don't have to experiment on living creatures.
It's a very common thing in a lot of cultures to completely disregard the sentience. Like even in engineering, the way they engineer pig farms or animal farms, you see that they're engineering in a very efficient way, but one thing is missing is like they're completely on recognizing that these animals are sentient.
But there's another, within that, there's another imperative which says, if you don't do this, someone else will, and you're out of business. So one part of you recognises the sentience of the animals, the other part of you recognises, I have to feed my family. So I don't think we should... There's an economic imperative that says if it's not against the law, then something is going to be done which is going to cut the costs. And the more you can cut costs and the more efficient you are, you have to do it because someone else is going to do it, and if you don't do it, you're out of business. So there's a kind of an inexorable logic to the industrialization of farming, that it isn't because people don't recognize the sentience of animals. It's to do with it's just to do with the that we in a way we've handed over our decision making to the market.
One question, but this thing is based on a wrong way to see the economy. That is the way we see the economy nowadays. That is, somebody needs to kill animals to feed people. But at the same time, this industry is killing the world because it's creating a greenhouse effect, and at the end, the solution will be the end of the world.
Yes.
Because then, in some ways, that is because we think our paradigm of economy is right, but it's wrong. It's based on something that is not really based on the future.
Yes, but it's not right or wrong. It's a system. You studied, right, systems theory. The market economy is just a system that if it isn't regulated, is going to behave in a certain way that's going to destroy the earth. And that's just... that's just a result of the way that the markets operate. And you can't really say that it's wrong. You can just say that it's irrational. But then...
it's incomplete.
Yes. Well, it's... but in a way, it's unconscious. It's not as if there's some conscious individual, because the governments that are trying to change the regulations to alter the way that the markets work are themselves controlled by the powers that are determining the markets. Do you know that the system? It's not as if there's somebody could just bravely stand up and say, "This is how you fix it." It's an entire system that's operating just as it should. Do you know that the parameters or the freedom of movement are very narrow? At the moment. Now, of course, if the climate starts to really stuff up and millions of people start to lose their livelihoods and world agriculture starts to break down, then the system will change. But do you see it in a way that there's not a right or wrong about the system. There's just I'm a poor human and I don't want the system to destroy the earth, but the system itself is just operating according to the structure.
Yes, I think in some ways it's Milton Friedman and all his group of economists, they sit down and they define this is economy, this is neoliberalism, is the economy, and yeah. is the way to, and they I don't know what was the order, if it was before the chicken or the egg, but then they were granted famous, were praised because they were excellent economists, that they saved Chile from a disaster. But all that economy was based on destroying really countries.
Yes.
The economy of countries also, if they tell no, but they are living better because now there is one chicken for two people, but the reality is that only one is eating the chicken and the other is not eating anything. Then, did you see, is also, I think it needs to be related with ideology and with control of everything,
yes.
the world.
Yes. Yes, agreed. But the at the same time, I'm pointing out is that the system of the world is the system of the world and needs to be understood, and the way that it operates and the way that everything feeds back on itself and the way that power works, all of it needs to be understood, and there's a certain inevitability to it that any kind of moral injunction saying that it's wrong, it's irrational, that fairness and equality should predominate, they're all forces that are just operating within the system. Ultimately, I don't think you can judge it. If it's going to destroy itself, I think, and that's okay. I mean, it's like an animal, right? It's like the death of the dinosaurs. There was a dinosaur colloquium saying we're going to die out. You know, we really ought to do something about it. No, there's nobody in charge of this world system who can say, oh, well, we should do that. There are a lot of individuals who see that if we did that, that would be a good thing. And if enough individuals say if we did that, that would be a good thing, that will change the system. I'm not saying that, but it's in a way I feel like morality hardly has anything to do with it. It's more like something like, I know this is an enormous digression, almost a sensitivity to the sentience of the organisms on the earth might become infectious in humanity. A sensitivity towards life might become infectious across the earth. There's a sign that might happen. And if such a sensitivity was genuinely became a part of our understanding of being, then that would have rippling effects. But we're a long way from caring so much about life that we would accept zero or negative growth in the economy.
Can I just ask a question?
John,
sorry.
Yes. Yes.
It's about something you said.
Yes,
before.
No, you should be bringing us back.
Dasein is world forming, and this is linked to language, which is created by Dasein.
Did I say created by Dasein? I'd like to strike
did,
that.
Yeah.
If
okay.
I could edit, if I could edit that.
Okay, linked to language.
Yes.
Right, and
also, we'll leave it open where language originates.
Okay, and would you also say that Heidegger would link world forming to history, historicity?
Yes.
History. Okay.
Yes.
And is it the language that's doing the world forming that he's attuning to? And would it be that the world forming could be done outside of language with another medium that could be attuned to, or is that just too much of an abstract?
I think for Heidegger, I mean, what his famous phrase is, language is the house of being. Mm-hmm. So he thinks in a way our can't use the word consciousness, our understanding of being is essentially connected is the wrong word, but it's the best word I've got, connected with language, and without language there wouldn't be world, and without world there wouldn't be language. They're almost inseparable. That would be the, but for him, you'd see, you've got to get to the bottom of what language is, that would be another exploration, like what is an organism. So because language isn't just the possession of a set of words, it's a possession of a state of being, and once you have that state of being, you have language in a certain sense. And now vocalizing sounds and symbols and having vocabulary is almost secondary to that capacity. We have a capacity for language that is part of our...
So he would side with Chomsky on that, would he? That, in the sense that we have capacity.
Well, no, because Chomsky's idea of that there's an innate grammar is different.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So language is more like a vehicle to the world rather than being the world. The language takes you to this, to these sensibilities and worlds, but the language itself is nothing. It's just a tool, it's a device, it doesn't have anything.
So Heidegger would certainly say, no, language is not a tool or a device like a hammer that you can pick up and let go. Language is where we live. You know, I'm talking about the water in which we live. Language is an inseparable part of the water in which we live. And it is. Do you see what you were thinking and trying to express to me about somehow there being a state of being outside of language? It's only possible for you to have anything like that to be in you, because there is language.
But would it be that the language is the medium for that to come out, or would it be that?
No, it's so that for Heidegger, there isn't any sense that language is somehow separate from us or is a tool or anything like that. Language is the medium in which we are.
Why can't there be other mediums with the same expression? Like, I remember Heidegger talking about the hand, or like the essence of the hand, like this, and then doing some other sign. About the hand being the medium, but the essence changes. Would that not be the same case with language?
I'm not sure what you're picturing. Because I'm
you mean a language without words?
No, like
like maths or.
I'm just a bit confused with the idea that the language was the was the world that we formed, and I'm a bit confused with that idea, and then an idea of language being, why wouldn't language just be a medium, and then the world that we formed would be something in behind what the medium is showing.
So I think, without going into it, because we're talking about Heidegger would say, well, I think he would say, he's not here today, he's not talking to me, that language isn't like that. We're thrown Dasein, we're thrown into the world, and the world is language, and we aren't outside language, we can't get outside language. Language is where we have our being, and to try and think yourself outside of language is a bit like the scientists trying to think themselves into this state of pure objectivity where you look down on everything from the outside. You can't look at anything outside of language. So so in a way, to think like that is to speculate about something that you can't possibly know of, because you can only speculate in language.
What about in like Eastern thought and meditation, when there is without like thought?
Yes.
Or like experience without thought.
Yes.
I don't think in language.
Yes. that's a good, that's, that expresses it better. Is there a state of pure consciousness that in some sense precedes language?
Yeah.
And is that in any way knowable? And I think that there is such a state, yes.
But I think, like, when you say knowable, it's not like...
Not knowable linguistically, not knowable reflectively, like, but knowable as in you have the experience. It's that you can be that very state, and in a sense, when you come back from that state, it's only through language that you could possibly express what it is.
Yeah.
But the state itself knows itself without needing language.
Yeah, that's the point that I was kind of confused at, because it would be like the language is. Yeah, that's where I'm getting
really confused. Yeah. So I'm with you now, and in a way, there's a state. That state, if we can speak of it, is a kind of knowing nothing. It's a knowing nothing, but in that knowing nothing, there's still the being of everything around you. It's not as if language has gone away either. It's just there's a tiny gap. I can't put it in a better way than that. Because what it means to me is, in some sense, there's a world. I was talking about this to Nicolette. There's a world forming power, if you like, that. Of course, it doesn't have language because it's formed the world.
You said, I can't put it. What do you mean by it?
What did I say? I forgot what I said now.
You said, I can't put it.
Well, no, I forgot and I said that, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And I don't know if that means anything, but there's a sense of...
a state of pure consciousness. I can't put it into words. I can't put... what a state of pure consciousness without language is like in words.
It's
because it's without language.
Yes, yes. And in a way, we're going back. I don't think you were at the very beginning of the first course, were you? You weren't here for that. So we did actually start from that place. Yes, which in a sense, Heidegger doesn't repudiate that, in as much, but he would say Dasein is being in the world, and that state of pure consciousness is a kind of an ideal pole that you can, in some sense, and Heidegger doesn't talk like this, but you can, in some sense, it can become known to you. Now, whether we're in very extraordinary, difficult to talk about, where you say, well, what is my being? Am I this being that's thrown into the world, or am I the world forming power? And in a sense, it's almost as if you can withdraw back into a world forming power that is behind everything, but you can't stay there, and then you move into. And then you move into, you're being thrown into the world where you're not a world-forming power. You're in the midst of it, and I think in a way we're back to the Husserl and Heidegger, because Husserl was tending towards this affirmation of the transcendental ego being the world-forming power, and Heidegger is towards the my being. My real being is my being here in the world, and that being is entirely within language. So, in a way that I don't like to prevaricate, there's a certain sense in which both are true.
I'm still not too sure about the language part, because
that world-forming power in some sense, it isn't any longer an individual. You know, it's an impersonal power. So it's but in some sense, you have to dissolve your own being an individual to in any way know it. So it's not a, it's just not a binary thing. Does that make any sense to you? Is that speaking to what you were thinking about?
I'm not too sure. I'm just confused with the language part, because like when I describe an observation, I'm using language, and it's based on like how well developed my vocabulary is to describe it. And I can do the same with a drawing, and it'll be based on how well developed my technique or vocabulary.
Yes, but what you're saying in a way is that I've got in my immediate experience, and then I use language to describe it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just like to tackle that, because that's where we are. Heidegger would say no. Your immediate experience is already structured by language.
Okay, but like, what would make language more of a prominent feature than a drawing or manipulating a material?
The very fact that you're seeing something and understanding something as a drawing means you have language in you.
But it could mean that the drawing was made before my vocabulary was developed to describe it.
Then it wasn't. It wouldn't have been a drawing for you.
What do you mean?
If you didn't have the language, it wouldn't be a drawing for you. And if you understand it as... Heidegger makes an enormous amount... I understand it makes an enormous amount out of the as. If you understand something as a drawing, as anything, you have language.
You're not the only person. Philosophers, Western philosophers, say exactly what you're saying, and this is completely false, isn't it?
Yeah. But what if you have the drawing and you don't say it's as that, but it's something else, but it's still an observation that was being described, but the description isn't fundamental like importance, but the drawing itself.
I'm getting too hot. I don't know how everyone else is. When my temperature goes too high, I can't listen anymore.
Before we develop language,
something like music transcends babies
only
to
have
its sound
to see.
A baby
that's all they can draw. They just go round and round and round and round. So that what they're doing there is not, they're not doing, it's not a drawing as a flower or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's only with the development of language that they start to be able to draw straight lines, and so start to be able to express actual things, which they begin to get a conception of something as a drawing, but they don't have that with a pre-linguistically, as far as I know.
Now, I'd like to pull this back a little bit, because in effect we're talking about an insight that Heidegger's had, and he's not arguing that language is like this. He's saying more that there's a certain insight that he's had, and he's inviting you to look to see if there's you can have that insight as well. Because it's the same as this. There's a parallel between this. Do you think that language is a kind of a tool? And our culture's understanding of language is that it's a kind of a tool. We're taught how to use it. We pick it up and we use it, and we put it down. And behind that, we have a kind of an experience of the world, sensory experience of the world. We listen to music, we see things that doesn't involve language. That's part of almost our background understanding of how things work here, which extends into technology, where we think that technology is like that as well, that our computers and our telephones and our electricity supply are kind of artifacts that we use and we're in charge of, and we pick them up and we drop them as according to our own will. And Heidegger's insight, or what he's trying to convey, is saying that that's a false picture of a certain subjective agent that doesn't really exist. and that, if you like, language speaks through us. Doesn't, we don't pick it up and drop it. It speaks through us. We don't really know what we're doing when we speak. And our entire, our entire understanding of the world in which we live is inherited, yes? And whether we're thinking or commenting or reflecting or whatever, it's an inherited understanding that's come from the past, from our culture, from our parents, from our understanding, and we're absolutely immersed in it. We see, whether we say it or not, we see windows. We know we're in a room. That entire background understanding, which Husserl called the life world, is utterly suffused with language and the distinctions that language makes. And if you took all of that away, our whole experience would disintegrate back to something that we don't. And when you say, what about our experience of music? It's all happening within the world. It's not saying that everything is a linguistic experience, but it's saying that the world and language are... But you see, Heidegger, in a way, is trying to put this across in this lecture, even though he never mentions language. What he mentions in this lecture is the manifestness of being or beings. And that, in a way, he's trying to say something you can't say with that phrase. And the other thing about language is that it's not, that doesn't mean that you can make everything explicit, that everything can be expressed in words. He also talks about, and so does Gadamer, that everything you say has the unsaid. Yes? The unsaid is part of language as well. Yes.
Was he influenced by Kierkegaard in that sense?
Well, I know he was influenced by Kierkegaard, yes. But I don't know, particularly in his understanding of language, because I don't know enough Kierkegaard.
We just covered it with Matt a couple of years ago about indirect communication. And I was listening to Hubert Dreyfuss again the other day, and he was talking about that. I think he was...
Yes.
I think language is used in a very broad sense, including association.
Yes.
Because like back then, maybe there weren't all these like this material about association.
Well, no, association was.
Well, this word exists in Heidegger's.
I mean, Hume, David Hume thought everything was about association, and he was back in the 1700s. So.
What we associate with the word. Yeah, connotation is more has to do with the meanings. Association is more kind of a physical thing.
How about the Germans? They like to sort of bolt words together.
Yeah. Yeah. Associate. Like, world of associations.
Yeah. So they would like, I can't think of any explanation. They have lovely words. They just bolt. They bolt concepts together. They bolt words together. And it's something in the middle there that I think.
When I tell you rippling, you associate this word with some kind of world sensations.
Yeah.
When you let a dog smell some kind of the smell of its own, it's a dog's own.
Yeah.
It's a form of association as well, that the door creates. It's a kind of a world of senses.
Like a reference.
A reference to a world of different sensations. Mm. Connotation is more has to do with meanings, abstract meanings, rather than sensations.
I would say connotation more like a sort of summoning or something.
Yeah, summoning. Yeah, summoning of an associate of some world, a sensation.
I was trying to think, there was an old word for the ocean. It was whale road? Whale road? They had loads of... Yeah.
And these associated, these worlds kind of exist, either some of them could be instinctual and some of them like out of experience. And you get a feeling of these type of references, as you said.
I learned one the other day, I can't remember the word, but it's this feeling of woodland solitude whilst walking through the woods.
Yeah, yeah. So you see that you expressed it like this.
Well, that's the
more
English, that's the English translation, but the German word is basically, it looks to me like two words bolted together. One is wood and one is an emotion.
Germans talk about Weltschmerz or world pain, don't they? And that's an existentialist thing.
So the ground of language is the manifestness of being. It's that beings are manifest to us. And the fact that beings are manifest to us is intimately connected with language. Our capacity for language is because beings are manifest to us. And the whole lecture is about that. And I'm going to cram you through some slides now, and I want no questions and no interruptions, because in a way the lecture's pertinent to what we're talking about. So let's start making a few distinctions. Organs are incorporated. So Heidegger wants to say that a pen is an independent being that is ready to hand for use by anyone who's capable of using a hammer. Yes, it's got this independence, whereas an organ is never present at hand like that, independently. It's incorporated into the being that uses it. And again, I guess we're all going to think. I'm already thinking of my bionic arm, you know, that I unclip and put down and then put it back on again. And in a way, you incorporate. There's an awful lot of philosophers who'd say, well, you know, when I pick up a hammer, I have incorporated it into my body for the amount of time that I use it. And there's even been brain studies that show that happens. You know, in looking at how the neurons behave, the neurons, if you use a tool and you're skilled with it, you start to incorporate the tool to be part of your hand. But so, I don't want to confuse the water too much, but Heidegger's saying, but no, there's something essentially different about the hammer. Even if you do incorporate it like that, you put it down again. If you take your bionic arm off, you put it down again, it's separable like that, and somebody else can plug it into that, you know, some other person can use it. But you see how the world's changed? To which point you say, yeah, but what about a heart transplant? You can actually take someone else's organ and put it into you. You know, so all of our technologies since then are making these distinctions very questionable. Or not questionable, but blurring them. But certainly, there's something there about an organ that it is incorporated into the body in a way that's... In a way that it always reminds me of Saving Private Ryan. If you haven't seen the movie, here's the Marine on Omaha Beach, and there's his missing arm. He's looking for his missing arm. I mean, this really affected me, this scene. If we had internet, I'd be able to play the He's just wandering around at Omaha Beach on D-Day looking for his arm. And there he's found it. That's a visceral example of how the arm has become a thing. Yeah? You can understand as well him wanting to look for it, wouldn't you? But how it was incorporated into you as an organ, as that was a part of you, yes? He's picked it up, and now it's become a thing. I'm sorry that it's such a shocking image, but it really drove it home to me. If somebody had just blown off my bionic arm, and everything's fine, I lost his bionic arm. He got a metal arm later, that got blown off, and he went and picked it up. It wouldn't be like this. Do you get the distinction that arm was my arm? It grew out of me since I was a child. Do you know it's made of my material. It is me, in a way that a metal arm is never going to be. I just wanted to give you that to say there's a meaning here, that we can get very intellectual about bits and pieces, but you see there's a feeling sense that you don't really know what your arm means to you, I think, unless something like that happens to you.
It's also, I would say, the body is an object of is an object of love. Maybe the word object is wrong. We love somebody's physical self. And I'm thinking, if somebody you love lost a leg, you might have loved their legs or something, thought they had beautiful, wonderful legs. But once it's become detached,
yeah,
it that really kind of makes me feel that, because my love wouldn't be directed to that anymore.
No. But you see, and as soon as it's detached like that,
yeah,
arm, do you see it becomes it has an entirely different being?
Yes, yes.
It really communicated, yes, to me, that movie, that the being of the arm, it's become another. Its being changes. It's a tremendously good example of what Heidegger means by being, and the being of that there are different kinds of being here. And to science, and to the arguments that I was just discussing, it's all just, remember, it's atoms and molecules. It's all the same stuff. It's all flattened. So the being of the arm is like the being of any kind of tool or instrument. But it's not. And you could, I know what the hard-nosed scientists are like. They would say, oh, yeah, well, that's just... That's just your subjective feeling about your arm. But it's more than that, isn't it? The arm has a... What's grown out of you, it's part of your being at a very deep level. The level that something that you can pull off, detach, and give to someone else, it isn't. Even though, if you give someone your kidney, that's a very... So it's not that you've died... I'm thinking of this because there's a friend of mine needs a kidney. In some sense, because the kidney is alive, it's still alive, you can incorporate that into you. There's something about being alive that's important here.
In that it's a giving of love, isn't it? When someone does donate their organ, because a kidney, obviously a live person can donate their organ to someone,
maybe brother, sister,
or whatever, friend, and that's quite a thing to do, I think. Yes. In giving it to somebody.
Yes.
I think it's quite a bond. Yes. As does people who die, and their organs are donated to somebody who needs them. It's quite a profound thing.
Yes. But. There's another distinction there, that when you get a heart, yes, there's something about it that it's alive. and that it becomes connected to your living system, that a thing like an instrument, a piece of, you know, the chip in the... That's why I was so horrified by this man saying he just can't wait to stick a chip in his son's brain. notwithstanding that you...
You incorporate a baby, don't you, when you have a baby growing inside you? You've incorporated that.
Well, not... I haven't experienced that, but I mean... No, but there's a... there must be... that's where it... That's another fascinating area, isn't it? Where... That is the baby must be your being. I'm looking, Joe. You haven't had a baby.
No.
No. No one's had a baby here. No. So we've got no authority here. We.
I have.
But you're not in the stomach. Yes. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm making gender assumptions here. You know, but I don't think any of the none of us have known that. Because there must be something extraordinarily strange about the moment of birth, right? The separation, which was something that really was you. At what point did it, it's when it started kicking and you got a picture? Is that the sense that there's something? I mean, it's a miracle, isn't it?
I was reading this article about a girl who claims, well, she's been told she's got PTSD from the trauma of being born. And I was talking to my mum about it, and she thought that I was saying that this girl had PTSD from the trauma of giving birth. When my mum gave birth to my older brother, he came out like this. and it was really shocking, but I think it was a trauma. We were talking about it the other day, and she recognised that she might have some form of PTSD even from that event. So... Yeah,
it is a big thing, the split that you experience when you're born. I mean, I think it's possible to remember it, not in any kind of like remembering what you had for dinner yesterday type of thing, but you can have therapies where you suddenly find yourself reenacting something that afterwards you think must have been your birth, and it is traumatic from people I've spoken to who've been through their own.
So I'm reminded again. This digression is another. It's another very interesting one.
Yeah.
No, it is. No, it's me. I started it. We went to Omaha Beach. That's not on the slide, is it? Don't think.
I was wondering how it is to have mentioned a worm, for example.
A what?
A worm. An intestine or something.
Yes. Yeah. No. That's very
uncomfortable.
Yeah, but we. No, let's not go there. But we're full of... No. We didn't need to know that. We didn't need to think about that.
Yeah. My brother got a bot fly.
No. Let's not have horrid feet.
The Amazon jungle. Oh, the doctors wouldn't... he was saying there's something living in here. He'd gone to the Amazon jungle to do some conservation of it. They wouldn't, they were saying, oh, that's something else. Finally, they cut it out, and that was quite traumatic for him, seeing it in the petri dish.
Oh.
This thing that had been growing. It's like body shock. I was thinking about that. That's how I imagine pregnancy to be. It's just no, body shock. No, like the fly. It's like something Cronenberg, I guess.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, we're going to get through this distinction now. Right, so firstly we got the organ is incorporated into the body, and I just wanted to give you a more visceral sense that, yeah, we know what that means. Again, usually by deprivation, by losing something or seeing someone else lose something. And then there's this sense that the pen, he's talking about pens rather than hammers, has no capacity for writing. It's ready. It's ready. It's serviceable, he's going to say later. You know, the pen is for writing, but it doesn't in itself have any capacity for writing, whereas he wants to say that the eye has a capacity for seeing. But then he wants to say, but like, it only has a capacity insofar as it's incorporated into a body. Like the arm had, the arm that was blown off lost its capacity as soon as it was separated. So that it's the capacity, but the eye has a capacity to see that a pen doesn't have.
and then he starts talking about how potentiality, between potentiality and possibility. That how does the potentiality become a possibility?
Yes.
Huh? Heidegger.
Yes. Yes, I didn't get the bit about he talks about potentiality, but I wasn't sure about what he was saying about possibility there. It slipped my mind, but I think we're going to come to the slide, aren't we?
Yeah, like how could in the universe as well, like how do you get the potentiality to become a possibility?
Yes, because the organism he wants to say has the capacity, which is a potentiality, to see already, whether it has eyes or not. Yes, and this is, you remember the Eagleman's program where the guy was blinded as a child. He didn't lose his capacity to see because it was still there. And he had the operation and he was able to see again, but the capacity was always there. The capacity is a certain potentiality that the organism has. But then the eye has it too, insofar as it's incorporated into the organism. Do you see? Because the organism has a wholeness. That means that the eye, once it's incorporated into the organism, has the capacity to see, but only insofar as it's part of the wholeness. Whereas we still wouldn't say that the pen ever has that capacity to write, even though it's in someone's fingers. There's something still distinct about the pen. It's not incorporated into your living unity. It's got that separability, that independence, that passing it aroundness. But again, you know, it's blurred. I'm immediately saying that. I can say, yeah, well, I'm just going to pass my kidney round. Do you know? But even then, that it's the manner in which it's incorporated that's significant. It's incorporated into your living unity. Because there's a whole branch of philosophy of mind that was very popular recently called the extended mind, which was the idea that your mobile phone, your computer and everything that you use is actually a part of your mind, and that it makes no difference that you stored things on your phone or in your memory.
What?
It's the thesis of the extended mind, and this really, you know, stuck in my throat, because of course it's the disproof of the extended mind thing, that there's really no distinction, is I take a hammer and smash the phone, I take a bullet and shoot it through your brain. You know, there's a difference, isn't there?
I'm reading this bit about this. It's a very interesting paragraph about possibility and potentiality. That, like, so it could be maybe that this device, the hand, our hand, is not the physical hand, it's just our something more abstract. That we're not attached to our organisms as they are in the physical world, but they embody a certain kind of essence. And, can I read this bit? The potentiality for seeing is essential possibility of the animal. It does not follow from this that every animal must in fact have eyes. It merely means that the potentiality for seeing is a possibility, as a possibility, is grounded as such in animality. But animality does not necessarily have to unfold into this particular possibility and allow eyes to develop in the animal. Yet animality must be so constituted in a specific manner of being in general that the potentiality for such possibilities as seeing, hearing, smelling, and touching belongs to it. How are we to grasp the character of this potentiality as possibility?
Yes, I'm getting the distinction between potentiality and possibility. Possibility is something that could happen, whereas it may or may not. Whereas potentiality is what lies behind the possibility and enables it. And it's got a kind of potentiality implies a certain power that the possibility doesn't have. Possibility is it's almost an external thing, isn't it? Like a flip of the coin. It's possible it comes up heads or tails, but the potentiality is something enduring that may or may not manifest. And it's the may or may not manifest which is the possibility. So, are we going to go to 12? Because I'm hopeful to get through here. Yes, and these are other important things about organs. The organism itself has these potentials, this potentiality. I think I'm jumping ahead to potentiality because we've been talking about it. I don't think we've come to it in the slide yet. Which means that the mode of how an organ has its being is that it actually grows out and is formed in the organism and absorbed into it and has its life. And you know, the destiny of the organ is part of the destiny of the organism. And it's all intrinsically about being alive, because the organs of the organism are themselves alive and need to be alive in order to be organs. And we can come down to the empirical side there. It's no longer, unless it's alive, it doesn't have any capacity. And it's a different, at an empirical level, you would say it's a different form of organisation to the form of a hammer or to the form of a piece of technology that isn't alive. And Heidegger doesn't talk in these terms because he predates, I think, a really good understanding of what metabolism is, because metabolism is what really distinguishes things at an empirical level. You know, you're part of the unity of a living organisation when you're an organ in an organism. It's got all of these aspects of self-forming, self-regulating, self-creating, self-maintaining, and everything depending on everything else. And if one essential part of the organisation of the organism fails, everything else fails. Everything's in a living unity. That the hammer or the piece of technology or even the chip or the metal plate that you put in your body, when you die, it's fine. It doesn't affect it. So there's a more empirical way of understanding this that Heidegger is saying. He's not thinking empirically though. He's saying, but this empirical side of, if you study metabolism, metabolism is a sign of another form of being, living being. But then Heidegger says some very, you know, if you feel Heidegger's a guru of some sort, an unfailing guru, he says some shocking things about machines that are just not true. So this is the organism itself produces organs and thus also produces itself, in contrast to the machine which requires the builder, who has that manner of being that is specific to man. So far, so good. You say that's the case. The machine also cannot stop or change its operation by itself. Not true.
No.
It's not true. What was he? The fact he could even fail to project that, even in 29, there were, you know, it was clear that it was possible. The idea of being able to program machines was prevalent then, if you bothered to look, I think. whereas the organism initiates, regulates, and changes its own motility. Well, so do machines now, don't they, clearly?
What does it mean by motility?
Movement.
Okay.
Movement and change. And if the machine is damaged, then it requires repair, and this can only be done by the specific manner of being belonging to a being which is also capable of producing a machine. Not true. So he fails to see the next step of the evolution of the machine, which is the programmable machine, which becomes, I mean, we're not going to have time to look at this. It becomes conceptualized, I think, in 1936, maybe, by Alan Turing, as the universal Turing machine. The universal Turing machine is a machine that can imitate any machine. And when he conceptualized the universal Turing machine, he conceptualized the modern computer. In his mind, before it was built, Alan Turing had the idea in all its purity, and it's still used when people want to reason about the nature of computation. They still think in terms of the universal Turing machine, and the universal Turing machine is an incredibly simple machine, and yet its form of organization is equivalent to all of our digital computers that we use now. And Heidegger just didn't know about it. Didn't know that there could be a universal machine, and didn't see the limits, that the limits of mechanism stretch far beyond what he's thinking here. So all his distinctions here, this is a sort of a good sobering moment, because you see that all of the distinctions he's here are just wrong. Except that ultimately, somewhere in the background, somebody had to build a computer. You know, Alan Turing had to have the idea of a computer. There was a human being behind it. But in a certain sense, once the genie's out of the bottle, we've now produced machines that can build machines, that can regulate themselves, design themselves, even build themselves. The initial impetus is just you need to build the machine that can do all that. And after that, it can roll itself forward. And we're back now where we were with materialistic science, because materialistic science says, well, that's all life is. Yes? Life is just a machine that can produce itself and regulate itself. And we're quite capable of reproducing machines that can do that ourselves now, because we can produce programmable machines. Not just programmable machines, we can produce programmable machines that can rewrite their own programs. Wow. And a programmable machine that can rewrite its own program looks very much like an animal. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Orthodox monks go like that the nest is the body and the bird is the essence. The nest is nothing. And the birds could be the bird's body, the bird's eyes is the nest, and the soul is the essence. Something like that.
Well, I'm not sure what you're saying there, Alex. But you remind me of my own feeling in Australia, which may be completely off the wall to one side, is that the birds were the tree's way of making a sound. And almost that the birds belonged to the trees, that the trees needed to express themselves in a more interesting way, so they produce the birds. That there isn't such a distinction as we make. But I didn't want to go in that direction, because in fact there is a distinction that we couldn't make. This is going back to Jonas, right? There is a definite distinction that distinguishes my body from the rest of the world. And that distinction isn't something I thought of or intellectualized. I live it. This body is my body. I have feeling sensation throughout it, and that it stops at the boundaries of my skin. The living unity of my body is something that I know immediately and directly. And this is the only evidence that we have, if you like, to contradict the understanding that everything is a machine. It would look like everything was a machine if we came from the outside and we didn't know that there's actually an experience going on. And the experience says, yes, it's the living material that forms the boundary of the experience. And this can't be, it can't sensibly be, sensibly is a good word, isn't it? Denied. And it's through that immediate experience of our own bodies that we can then look at the dogs and the sheep and the birds and even the trees, you know, and we have almost an instinctual affinity with life that we know that these two are independent beings like we are, independent in the sense that there's a boundary around which their living life is an experiential life. So although Heidegger underestimates machines, that doesn't invalidate the distinction that we can make between machines and living beings. It's just we have to look more carefully now at what it is that defines being alive. And that's where we have to go into the idea of autopoiesis and metabolism. Of course, the question being, why does metabolism cause a different kind of being? And the answer to that is, whatever way you look at things, you end up with a certain ground which you just accept as that's the way it is. And that if you start from mechanism, you have to try and explain consciousness and life and experience. But if you start from experience, you don't have to explain experience. You say experience just is. Why? And your ground for saying experience just is your experience. Right, we're coming up to 12. I just wanted to stop on that because, to get to that, it's hovering in the background of our age. You can see Heidegger could make statements like that and everyone would nod along, whereas now it would cause an uproar. And most people in analytic philosophy of mind would just say, well, he just doesn't understand the nature of machinery now. Gone very quiet, hasn't it? All right, lunchtime.